KaiserNetwork.org.
But you look like you're all ready, so. Good morning, everyone. I'm Drew Altman from the Kaiser Foundation. Welcome to the Barbara Jordan Conference Center. It's always good to see so many interested, and some of you are even smiling people ready to discuss a heavy topic. That's what we do in the Barbara Jordan Conference Center. We discuss a lot of issues in this room. We have a lot of high-profile events from Bono to some of you. I think we're here, a supercharged event just a week and a half ago or so with Bill Cosby, but I will admit to you that we have our share of more geeky, technical, inside baseball events in this room, which we dearly love and will never give up and which draw big audiences. But there is no topic we discuss in this room that we care about more than this one. Katrina, New Orleans, Louisiana, the Gulf. It's become part of the fabric of our organization. It's an issue that we care about very deeply. We tried to get involved just as fast as we could after the hurricane and the floods. Our first effort was a survey. Some of you in this town will remember that we did with the Washington Post of evacuees and shelters in Houston just to try and give them a voice in the debate, which was swirling at the time in those early days, and try and get some facts on the table. And that early project has now grown into quite a broad effort that involves technical assistance on issues we know well at the Kaiser Foundation, like Medicaid and other public programs in health. If it's a public program that touches on health, as you know, we do it. Efforts to keep the health dimensions of the reconstruction and the facts about it before the policy community and policymakers in Washington, that's what this briefing today is all about. Efforts to keep the challenges in New Orleans and in the Gulf before the country. For example, by telling the individual stories of survivors in print and in video. And I don't need to tell you that sometimes those stories, they're upsetting, and sometimes they're disturbing, and sometimes they're downright depressing. But just sometimes there are happy, unexpected results. In the video that you'll see today, you'll see the story of a woman named Dawn, who we've been following for some time now. She's a low-income lady with a heart condition, without insurance, who was forced to ride a bicycle through the streets of Baton Rouge to find a doctor in those early days after Katrina. And it turns out her daughter, whom she'd given up for adoption when she was young, but then had recontacted several years ago, had been searching for Dawn, had been searching for her mother after Katrina. But she'd pretty much given up. She'd given up her mother for dead. And just as a last gasp, you know, it's the modern age, she decided, well, I'll try and Google her name. So she Googled her. She spotted her name on our website. She spotted the video. She called Jackie Judd on our staff, who, of course, had made the video. And through Jackie, she found her mom. And now today, they're reunited. So it's kind of an amazing, amazing good news story. And I'm sure glad that we invested in improving the search engine on KFF.org last year, which we did because you couldn't find our fact sheets often enough. I never thought it would lead to this. And you can rest assured that we're continuing our work in all of its parts on Katrina. For example, soon we'll launch the first of three waves of large surveys of health access in New Orleans, what people there say about their health care access, but also what they have to say about their health circumstances generally, what they have to say to the country and to us about the reconstruction as well. So we'll start in September, and stay tuned to your radio dials for that one as well. And so the briefing that we're doing today, it's part of this larger body of work, and that's why I started with that. And what we're doing today is taking the pulse of where things stand in the healthcare part of the reconstruction in New Orleans with a panel of national experts and also frontline leaders from New Orleans and from Louisiana who Fred and Karen have also become colleagues and friends as we've worked and worked in New Orleans and in Louisiana. And you can tell that they've become colleagues and friends because they've taught me to say Tulane instead of Tulane. I'm from Boston. And they've taught me to say insurance instead of insurance. They have not yet convinced me to order Grits and Debris, which is the health food breakfast of choice at the local place that Karen takes you to when you visit down there. But she's working on that. Our panel will be moderated by our Executive Vice President and Kaiser Commission Executive Director, Diane Rowland, who heads up much of our work on Katrina and is deeply, deeply committed to it, to all of our work in, on Katrina and leads it. And Diane will introduce the new video, and she'll tell you about the report that you have in your packets as well, and she'll introduce the panel in just a few minutes. But first, as you know, we've also done a new poll on the American people and Katrina, which I will briefly review. It was a short poll. It was not one of our mega polls. We wanted to see what the American people are thinking about Katrina almost a year after, maybe 10, 11 months after, because the feeling you get when you're talking to people on the streets in New Orleans, the feeling you get from people is that the country has moved on, they've forgotten about us. Some people just kind of tell you that, and some people frame it as a question, have people forgotten about us? We wanted to see if that's true. We wanted to see what the broader impact of Katrina has been on the country, on some key issues, on the American psyche. So let me show you some of the findings from that poll, just to get us started today. And here's the first one. Let's start with this. We wanted to ask people, are they still thinking about this? You know, is it in their heads or is it completely out of their minds? And so we asked people, are you thinking about Katrina these days and its aftermath or not? And here's what we found. 11% of the American people said, well, no, I'm not really thinking about this anymore at all. And a big chunk, another 29%, said, well, no, I don't really think about this very often. 40% said, I do think about it, not all the time, but somewhat often. And then 20% said, I really do think about this a lot. I think about it very often. And this, of course, includes everyone at the Kaiser Foundation and at the Mailman School and at Morehouse. So I don't want to hit this one too hard. It's just one finding. It's a place to start in showing you the poll results. But we can tell you that 60% of the American people do say that this is at least somewhat on their minds. And we certainly did not find that the majority of Americans are saying, you know, no, I don't think about this anymore. This is just not in my mind at all any longer. A lot of people are still thinking about this at least a little bit. So when they're thinking about it, when people do think about this, do they have a realistic view? Are they out to lunch? Do they exaggerate? Do they have an overly optimistic view? That was the next question. We asked people, are things back to normal in New Orleans? Here's what we found. Only 2% of the American people said, well, I think things are completely back to normal. I think this would probably surprise people in New Orleans, at least the people I talked to on the streets there. 11% said, well, you know, some work to be done. Most people are back to normal. A whopping 52% said major work to be done to get the city back up and running again. And 30%, a big number, said the city is still in crisis. So I would say a pretty realistic view. And I suppose you've got to give the news media, you don't have to, I would suggest we should, give the news media a fair amount of credit for this, because there's no other way that the American people really learn about what's happening in New Orleans. You could call it the Anderson Cooper and Brian Williams effect, but I'm guessing a lot of you aren't going to want to call it the Anderson Cooper and Brian Williams effect. But there it is, a pretty realistic view. Here's another way of measuring. Do the American people think that the help is getting down to the level of real people in New Orleans? So we asked, have people hit by Katrina gotten the help that they need? And the first thing we found is that a not small number, you know, more than one in five, almost a quarter, said most people have gotten the help that they need. But we also found that a pretty whopping 70% said most people have not gotten the help that they need. So again, a sense that things are not back to normal on the part of most of the American people. People are still struggling. And just an editorial comment, as indeed they are, if you go down there and take a look, and as you'll hear today. So, all right, the next obvious question then, do people think that more needs to be done, specifically that the government needs to do more? And so we asked them that, Has the federal government done enough to help state and local government? Should it do more? And we found that a big number, 30%, said, well, we think the federal government's done enough. But a bigger number, a majority, 56%, said, federal government has not done enough, by implication, should do more. So even with the billions of dollars spent, and I would say more importantly, with all the stories that everyone's seen about corruption and inefficiency and what's that expression, being FEMA'd and all of that, you know, a clear majority certainly feels that more needs to be done, which I think is a significant finding. I'll talk about it more in a minute. Here is a different kind of question now, because it's not about what the American people think about New Orleans, but it is instead about what the American people think about the impact of Katrina on the American psyche overall. I'll just show you one result that has to do with this, and it's this one. Many people have speculated about this. We debated how to ask about it. We finally decided to do something you don't often do in polling, which is just to ask people straight out. So we did, and you can see what the result is here. It's not good news. A majority of the American people said that the whole experience had a negative impact on their confidence in government. It is entirely what you would expect, right? No surprise in that. But it is certainly not good news. Now, in our surveys, we always look beyond the averages, and we try and look beyond the aggregate numbers to see if there's a deeper story to tell as well. And we did that in this case. And there were a couple of other things that are worth pointing out to you from this survey also. Beneath the averages and beneath the aggregate numbers. And one is this, the differences by race, and I won't read the chart to you because you can all read and because I can't see that far anyway, but first you see these significant, substantial differences by race, and that just makes sense because we all know the disproportionate impact that Katrina had on African Americans in New Orleans. And we all remember the images, the powerful images of that disproportionate impact, the images of the impact on African Americans that everybody in America saw on their television screens, the people on those rooftops in New Orleans. And it's important to remember the powerful impression that that made on the African American community in our country. So these are significant differences. And it's, I think, useful to keep this one in mind, beneath the averages and the aggregate numbers. And then there was one other that I think is worth pointing out in the survey, and it was these differences by political party. Again, I won't read the chart to you because it's a long one, but you can see very significant differences on a whole set of measures, particularly, of course, between Republicans and Democrats, with the independents, where they always are, somewhat in the middle. What is going on here? A couple of things. A combination of preconceptions and beliefs that are different between Republicans and Democrats that they bring to the table when they answer survey questions. About what? About government, about their feelings about government, about personal responsibility, but also a rallying around the president on the part of Republicans and a not rallying around the president, an antipathy towards the president on the part of Democrats that they bring to answering the survey questions. And this has all kinds of implications that I won't get into today because this isn't a political talk. But the only point I want to make to you is this is part of the general political landscape you're all familiar with in our country. It is not at all specific to Katrina. And so for that reason, I put in the middle of a Katrina presentation a chart on, guess what, Iraq, just to make the point to you that this is not a Katrina-specific phenomenon. This almost perfectly symmetrical chart, just to underscore that this is the general political landscape that we see in our country today. And finally, probably the biggest question of all, does the public think the federal government is better prepared for a major disaster as a result of Katrina? Now, this is any kind of disaster. This isn't a hurricane. This is a hurricane, or it's an earthquake, or it's a dirty bomb, or it is, God forbid, a nuclear explosion, the kind of thing that pretty much everyone thinks is coming someday. I think this is probably the most important question we asked. And as you can see, more people said yes than no. But it's fair to say that the response was decidedly lukewarm, nothing to write home about, certainly nothing to crow about. So overall, I would say the implications for New Orleans and the Gulf were more positive than negative, because Americans have not totally forgotten. They have a pretty realistic view of where things stand. It's not clear that this is a big enough issue, a salient enough issue for the public to force politicians to do more, but it suggests that the public certainly would be receptive to whatever initiatives may be taken by politicians and by political leaders in the future. And certainly, it's not a public that's saying, enough's enough, we've done enough, we've spent too much money. Quite the opposite is what we found in this survey. And that's interesting, maybe even surprising at a time of war, at a time of rising gas prices, at a time when the American people have other concerns. The implications for the country as a whole are probably not as positive because, as you could see, Katrina left some scars in terms of another blow to the public's faith in government, and confidence in government's ability to deal with disasters has certainly been weakened at least a little bit. So, okay, with that, that's what we found in the poll. It's time to focus exclusively on health care for the rest of the morning. You can save, if you have any questions about the poll for later on, I can come back up. I'm not going anywhere, and I can come back up later when we have the discussion. And with that, thank you. I'll turn it over to Diane, who will lead the rest of the morning's discussion. Thanks.
Thank you, Drew. Well, as Drew said, we have lots of briefings here in this building and in this room on what might happen or could happen and what policy options are on the table. But today our focus is really on what did happen, what was done in response, and what remains to be done in the aftermath of Katrina. It's hard to believe that 1 year ago, New Orleans and the surrounding Gulf Coast was a different place. For most Americans, it was a city, New Orleans, of music and good food, tourism and conventions, Mardi Gras and Jazz Fest. But beneath the party and the tourism, we saw one of the nation's poorest areas, where one in four lived in poverty on less than $1,400 a month for a family of three. One in five was uninsured. Poverty and lack of insurance combined with a large minority population, Louisiana, one-third African-American, Mississippi, 37%, compared to 12% in the U.S. So what Katrina did for us was it rolled back the cover and exposed the poor and the disadvantaged, and it put their lives, their struggles, and their health and social needs on TV for all of us to see. It peeled back the facade of good times in the Big Easy to reveal the deep gaps in how we as a nation address the needs of the poorest and sickest among us. Today's event, then, is part of our continuing effort to learn the lessons of Katrina and to keep a focus on the people whose plight was so exposed by the aftermath of Katrina. And with this focus, to help promote solutions that respond to the needs of the poor, the voiceless, the often forgotten. As part of this effort, we want to share with you today a video that updates some earlier work we did, highlighting the experiences of some of the survivors of Katrina and the healthcare workers trying to provide care and comfort to them. We conducted a series of structured interviews in New Orleans over the last year, focusing in February and then following up this summer on 44 survivors of Katrina. They are highlighted in the report included in your packet, Voices of the Storm, Health Experiences of Low-Income Katrina Survivors. But now, also with us today, through a new KFF video, we can bring some of these survivors to you to see and hear their experiences. We dedicate this video and today's session to the survivors of Katrina. May their stories be told. May their struggles not be forgotten, and may we move to correct the disparities that led to the tragedies we saw after Katrina. I'm going to show the video now and have you see the voices and hear the voices of the people. But I'd like to thank, first of all, Jackie Judd, who helped put this video together, and the many staff who worked with her, John Samelian, Samantha Artiga, Adele Schortzer, David Rousseau, and Brandy Simmons. And I want to also thank the music that you're going to hear. The music for the film was composed and played by Lynn Ingabar, who fled New Orleans during Katrina. Lynn is here today, and I believe just turned 16. And I'd like him to stand up so you can acknowledge him before you listen to his beautiful music. And with that, our video.
Katrina and the damage done to New Orleans' healthcare system and the people who depended on it can still shock.
Every day of my life, every month, every year, I'm not going to forget this one.
We had 42 inches of water, so the charts and the furniture, which was all paid for, became good in the shape.
New Orleans has it really. I mean, it's not bad the way people think. It is not bad the way people think.
I don't think that any of us could have imagined, even in our broadest imaginations, I couldn't have been prepared for what we ended up having to face.
It looks like our emergency backup is gone now.
What they faced was the shredding of the safety net for New Orleans. Kinds of ways.
I'm wondering if I could get me some nerve medicine.
Because you don't have any doctor now who will prescribe that?
That's right. I can't find the doctor.
I had my old pool and the hurricane came along and I didn't get my false teeth till just about a month ago.
For months after Katrina, the exodus of doctors left virtually no specialists to treat patients in need of more complex care. Even now, orthopedists, oncologists, eye, ear, nose, and throat doctors are hard to find and far away when they can be found.
Now, when you go home and you think over an hour away from medical care, not a big deal. You have a car, you have insurance, it's not your world. Imagine that you're uninsured, that you don't have a car, that you're a laborer, or in fact that you work in a close by hotel or restaurant performing service duties and just not insured. What's your ability to get connected to a clinic over an hour away?
Up to date on your tetanus shot?
Yep.
Danny Martin is one of those laborers, part of the new migrant workforce rebuilding New Orleans. Like so many of them, Danny is uninsured.
Getting medication here, nobody seems to want to help me. All the agencies keep telling me because I'm not a New Orleans, I'm not from here, there's nothing they can do for me.
Oh, I'm not good with shots, though.
Common Ground, a community-based volunteer organization, saw that need, migrant workers in a stretch-thin city, and is trying to fill it.
We have tetanus shots and hepatitis shots. During flu season, we gave flu shots. We treat a lot of skin conditions, a lot of respiratory illness, particularly people who are doing demolition and working in really moldy environments.
The makeshift clinic is part of the patchwork of health centers providing free or low-cost care. Floodwaters inundated the Daughters of Charity Health Center, damaging 30,000 patients' records. With the city's help, the center is one of the few safety net clinics that managed to reopen. Smaller and more out of the way than it was, but up and running.
How do you reconstruct their health records and their needs?
We start over again, so you ask the patient, you sometimes even remember. It's amazing sometimes what you can remember. And when we get the old records completely dried out and delivered, we'll have to merge those charts.
We're going to do a new chart on you, okay?
Sheila Webb is the former health director of New Orleans and now helps operate several clinics for the needy. It's been nonstop since Katrina, opening clinics in Baton Rouge for displaced people, but able to reopen only one in New Orleans. Her fatigue is apparent, as is the frustration.
The people who are suffering more today are the people who suffered before the storm. They're the same people, Jackie. They are the people who were the disenfranchised. They are the ones who were the uninsured. They were the ones who did not have access to care.
The experiences of three people Kaiser interviewed in February and again this summer tell different parts of that frustrating story, along with some signs of relief.
You don't need anything else? I think that's it.
Linda Henderson fled her home, her job, her family, and found shelter in a Baton Rouge church building where she has been with her grandson ever since. With her job went her health insurance and the ability to buy diabetes and cholesterol drugs.
If you were to go into the pharmacy with a prescription, what would that cost you?
It would cost me at least about $30, $40.
For a month's supply?
For a month's supply, yes.
And that's out of reach?
Oh, yes.
Linda went without her medication through the fall, winter, and spring until she finally managed to qualify for Medicaid. Within weeks, the state notified her she was about to be cut off. Today, Linda is fighting to buy herself a bit of time before having to requalify later this year. She says her faith in God and in herself helps her cope with the uncertainty.
I never was one to just sit at home and, you know, wait for someone to do something for me. I've always been this independent person who just get out there and do what I have to do to take care of Linda Rose. That's just the way my mother raised me.
Susan Finnemore credits luck, resilience, and religious faith for being alive. Katrina left her cut off from her doctors and medications for HIV/AIDS and a host of other problems.
I'm on a cocktail, and it's four medications that work together. Without one, they can't work.
Weeks after the hurricane, a friend gave Susan shelter in New Orleans, and she worked the phones until she got herself back on track medically. Then, this spring, she almost died of pneumonia. Susan is on Medicare and Medicaid, and the safety net did catch her. 3 weeks in a hospital, and now in a nursing home. Susan hates institutional living, but housing in New Orleans has become completely unaffordable. She keeps her HIV status a secret from other residents here. Soon, she will lose her AIDS doctor, who stayed through the storm, but won't stay any longer.
He's not assured of a job after, like, December. They don't know what they're going to do.
Susan has now asked all of her doctors for letters about her treatment, so she is prepared for the next hurricane.
Don't give me a kiss.
Don Pontikakis sees rain now and thinks the next hurricane is here.
Didn't get up to eat, didn't get up to do nothing. Just stayed in one big ball in the middle of the bed.
Through the spring, Dawn lived in a FEMA hotel in Baton Rouge, pedaling her way through this new city once while she was having chest pains and heading toward a hospital in search of someone to take care of her.
After all this time, I found a doctor, you know, and Dr. Wagner, and she's at Baton Rouge General, you know. And, like, if it wasn't for them, because I was feeling sick, I was feeling really bad, you know, and it was my legs were swelling up like this, you know, and I couldn't even hardly stand on my feet.
On Cat Through News. Yeah.
Today, Dawn lives in a small house, helping raise two little boys whose mother she met at the hotel. Her chronic illnesses are now being managed, though she says she cannot get the vascular surgery she needs. And Dawn's mental health has deteriorated, like so many others after Katrina.
I was doing pretty good. And now, you know, I have good days, I have bad days, you know. Sometimes I feel like not even getting up. Some days I feel like doing away with myself. I know that sounds bad, and you know, but I just can't help it. I still feel like everything's been taken away from me. It'll never be the same, never.
Rebuilding lives and systems is a very long-term prospect. In New Orleans, Charity Sister Hospital University is supposed to open for limited services this fall, and the department store clinic would then close. It's a beginning.
I shifted my gaze, and I don't look for a year. I look for 5 to 7 to possibly 8 years for recovery.
Is there a common vision yet about what needs to be built in New Orleans?
At a high level, there's absolute agreement there. The work that we have to do now is take that from a high level to specifics and say, okay, what does this look like on the ground?
Are there days when you believe you can't meet that goal?
I think if I said that there was no doubt at all, I'd be lying.
We don't want it to be what we had before. We want it to be better, you know, than what it was before. And so I think some of the challenges that we face is deciding that what that better is going to be.
In the near future, better means some certainty about the availability of doctors and hospitals and affordable medicine, so that when the next anniversary of Katrina comes along, life may be a little easier for these survivors of the storm.
I would like to be right here at this house barbecuing. That's what I'd like to do. And thanking God for another year.
And thank you again, Lynn, for your music and your contribution. And thank you all for being here today to share with us both this video and also this discussion that we want to engage in about the challenges and choices ahead in rebuilding and recovering from Hurricane Katrina. We have with us today an incredible panel that can help guide us through this discussion. Dr. Fred Cerise is the Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health and Hospitals. You saw him in the video. You know he's responsible for the statewide effort to develop a comprehensive plan to reform and rebuild health care. So I know he will provide us with a good overview of the current efforts, and he's well aware of all of the challenges facing Louisiana in this rebuilding effort.
We also have with us Dr. Karen DeSalvo from the Tulane School of Medicine, who is on the ground trying to provide and build capacity for community clinics to help deliver care and establish medical training for those who are there as residents. With us also is Dr. David Dosa of Brown University, who has been assessing the response for nursing home residents and other vulnerable populations and trying to look at ways to improve evacuation efforts. They're going to talk to us about their perspectives from New Orleans, but then I want to turn to some broader perspectives from national experts working in the Gulf region, Dr. Dominic Mack from the Morehouse School of Medicine and Dr. Erwin Redlener from the Mailman School at Columbia and co-founder of the Children's Health Fund are going to be with us this morning to help comment on some of the health needs and disaster response planning that is required. But I want to start first with Fred to give us his perspectives on the challenges that have been faced over the last year and those that are ahead. Fred.
Thank you, Diane. And I'll echo the comment from the audience. Well done, Kaiser. Kaiser's been a wonderful supporter of the state throughout this entire ordeal, and we certainly appreciate all the attention you've given us and the help you've given us along the way. Diane, thank you. I'll just take a couple minutes and give a very brief sketch of some of the our major challenges and how we're looking at going forward. The context or some of the numbers I tell you have to you put them in context when you think about the population. A lot of estimates out there. Probably our best guess at this point is from roughly 1 million people in the area, now there may be 650,000 people in the area now. That's you know, one guess or a number of surveys ongoing and that have been done. It's difficult to put your finger on a lot of the demographics. We try to capture how many people are uninsured now. Some of the surveys done by the city would indicate that uninsured rate is not different than the baseline, which was very high, 20% uninsured rate. Yeah, I think just practical experience tells you we've gained some new uninsured individuals. We've lost a lot of uninsured if you look at the areas of the cities that have been destroyed. And so we have ongoing efforts right now. In fact, there's a very aggressive effort in the city right now with the CDC and Census Bureau and the state looking at trying to get a better idea of some of those numbers and demographics. Our biggest challenge is I have to do with just the oddity of this entire situation of putting a society back together in mass. It's not as if you were going to evolve back into normalcy here. And so we've got issues dealing with workforce and infrastructure that are just incredibly complicated because we don't have the infrastructure in the city to support that. And so when we look at workforce issues, things like housing become such an important piece that's just a hard thing to overcome. We know, based on some surveys that we've done, that we've got a significant loss of physicians. We just recently completed a phone survey that shows primary care physicians may be down as low as 35%. Looking at one of our major insurers, Blue Cross, they show that they've claimed from about 50% of their providers in the area that were there before Katrina. So probably somewhere between 35% and 50% is a fair number for physicians remaining in the area. We know as you drill down, we've particularly got a shortage of things like psychiatrists. We've got a shortage of dentists in the area. We knew we had a shortage of nurses and nurse assistants and nurse aides in the area before Katrina. Looking at a number of measures, we know that those situations have been exacerbated. And then infrastructure is another issue. You heard in the video we've lost a number of facilities that were providing care in the past. We've moved from a situation where, in general, we were over capacity in a number of areas, whether that be hospitals or nursing facilities, or other providers of care to a situation where now in most of those areas we have a significant undersupply of resources. And so the challenge before us now is how can we, as we rebuild, try to right-size this delivery system in the process. And so as we look forward and look at rebuilding, what we realize is, you know, before Katrina, we had a system in our state that was no different in qualitatively than the rest of the country. In magnitude, we were an exaggeration, and that is we had high costs and poor outcomes in our delivery system. And so as we go forward, how can we address that? This is not a problem strictly of the uninsured. In fact, you know, I noticed once again last month in Health Affairs, they noted once again that it's not the uninsured that are driving our costs. I mean, they use fewer services. It is our delivery system in general that's a high-cost delivery system. And so as we look at this, we can't look at this as, you know, how do we fix the problem of the uninsured? Certainly we have to address those needs within this context, but it's an overall delivery system fix that we're looking, or improvement that we're looking for as we go forward. And so we've initiated an effort it's a broad effort, legislatively directed, as a large collaborative that's been pulled together to look at, you know, how to put the pieces back together so that as we address the gaps in our system going forward, we do so in a way that that is smarter for the future. And so building upon, for instance, the principles that the Institute of Medicine laid out about systems that will be safe and timely and effective, efficient and equitable and patient-centered. Those kind of principles we're looking to build in to the recovery. And as I said in the video, the tough work is how do you go from that broad level of agreement to the specifics of implementing these improvements. But basically the approach we're taking right now is looking at what we want in a delivery system, what are our gaps right now based on the current assessments, and then as we put resources in, how do we best fill those gaps? I'll give you one just real quick example. As we had an opportunity to have some funds to support these safety net clinics on the ground, and we're able to use about $22 million to support those clinics to keep them providing services for a period of 12 to 18 months while we get to a more stable time. One of the expectations we put in there was that these clinics, as they became stable, that they would implement electronic medical records. You saw the problem with the medical records in the video. And so while we are providing immediate support and longer-term support, trying to build in these expectations of a more high-performing system along the way. So that's a very high-level overview of kind of our challenges and where we're going with this. Diane, I'll turn it back to you.
And now Karen will take us to the ground. So, yes, wonderful video, by the way, and thank you all for coming today. I'm so excited to see that there's people who really do still care because we have a fair amount of work to do on the ground. I think Peter's assessment of a 5 to 8 year timeline is more appropriate than I care to admit, actually, in terms of thinking towards the future. And so I just want to share with you sort of the ground level in New Orleans, what it's like there, what we've achieved in the last few months, where the gaps still are, and sort of some specific things that we're looking to see happen. And, you know, just to clarify or just to put it into context, that the work that's happening on the ground in New Orleans is really designed to sort of prepare the ground, if you will, and plant the seeds so that when we make the policy changes, they'll be able to meet those that meet that, and we will have already a fertile ground where things are prepared so that when we have changes in incentives and payment reform and support for primary and preventive care, those things are already there and don't have to be built post hoc. So from last August, we've come a long way. Some of you may know that we were sort of practicing with card tables and ice chests for a while, and you saw some of that still going on, actually, in parts of town. But we have gotten a lot more infrastructure at our disposal to sort of rebuild the safety net. And what we're trying to rebuild as a safety net is one that really will catch people when they fall, one that's not sort of centralized in the downtown area of New Orleans, but really spread out across Region 1 so that people can theoretically bike or walk to their doctor's office and not have to take a couple of buses to get there. You know, the way I trained and I think the way Fred trained in Louisiana was just that. We sort of had all of our doctors and our safety net really concentrated downtown, and we really want to flip that so that it's much more patient-centered and much less doctor-centered. The kinds of things we're doing there, actually, Fred mentioned that we have had some support from the social services block grant. We've certainly had a lot of support nationally from folks who are part of foundations like the Kaiser Family Foundation and others. We've had support from Irwin, the Children's Health Fund, support from Morehouse. I mean, I think the entire panel up here has provided some support for the safety net rebuild in New Orleans. And really, I think the limited resources that we have had, we've been able to stretch because we've been able to create partnerships on the ground. And if I were to sort of tell you the one thing I think we've achieved in this storm, though, it is recreating a broader safety net system, one that is more distributed ambulatory care. The real success story has been the breakthrough where academics has partnered with government and partnered with foundations and partnered with nonprofits and social service agencies. We've all sort of come out of our walls, if you will, to create a new fabric in the city that I think will, in the future, mean much better patient care, something that's much more patient-centered for the future. Some examples of the kinds of things, one is something called the Partnership and Access to Healthcare Network, which pre-storm was really looking at helping safety net practices, the couple of FQHCs that we had, to implement electronic health records, and they repurposed themselves and sort of opened up and said, anyone who wants to join as part of the safety net system can. And so you saw Common Ground on the video. They're part of that. They're sort of originally a kind of a faith-based organization that's now transformed themselves. Tulane is part of that. LSU, the city, the state clinics, the FQHCs, the charity hospital system. I mean, it's a laundry list of very typically different kinds of providers who all have the same mission, which is to create a future health system that's patient-centered, that is safe and effective and has high quality for everybody that comes through the system. And it's really been a wonderful sort of activity to participate in, especially as an academic, because we often are so focused on our mission of training that we really, I think, lose sight of the fact that there's a whole world out there that our trainees are going to go work in when they finish. And so the added benefit, in addition to what we're doing for patient service, is what we're trying to do to reform medical education on the ground. And this is something, actually, in efforts that were led by our residents back in September, who both Tulane Medicine and Pediatrics residents and LSU Emergency Medicine residents, who really showed a lot of initiative and showed us as faculty that what was really important to them was creative health care that was very patient-centered, and that we had been putting them in a box someplace that prevented them from doing the kind of care delivery and training that they wanted. And so as we recreate the safety net system, one of the goals of our network is that we want to ensure that it's an environment where people can train, and people, not just physician health professionals, but also nursing and social services and PT and OT and everyone who might actually be part of the healthcare team for the patient, and train them all in a community-based environment so that they have that framework, that paradigm, if you will, of care delivery, and they train together so they begin to understand what are the issues and skill sets that these other partners on the healthcare team actually have. And it's happening on the ground. It's not a dream. It's real. And I think that's one of the exciting post-storm events. And frankly, it was kind of accidental because we all needed each other. And there are circumstances, for example, where people lost their building, and so we became co-located. Like the Metropolitan Human Services District, who does mental health, didn't have a building, and we had a building that was given to us by Covenant House, and that used to be a boys' dorm. So then we all said, well, let's just share this space, and now we have a sustained partnership where services are co-located for patients. I think one of the other pieces that has been mentioned, and I can't emphasize enough, is how important it will be for us to not only walk away with a distributed ambulatory system that's a true safety net, that's a fabric, if you will, and not wholly, but also that we have information at our hand, so that we have an electronic health record, and not just one that sort of sits in the office. It's like giving people a cell phone, but not giving them a cell phone plan. It doesn't really help. So if we can connect them and make them interoperable, we will really go a long way in advancing our health system into where I think it should be in 2006, and really hopefully projecting into the future, and be able to measure and monitor what we do, which means we can improve it and be able to give patients information about the kind of care they're receiving, so there's better transparency. And I think that's going to help as we try to move towards a system that rewards better quality of care instead of just more care, which is what we all certainly on the ground want to see happen. And we are actually engaged in a project as part of our ambulatory network on the ground to help each other roll up electronic health records, and we hope to have that in most of the clinics by the end of September. So the last mile will be done, if you will. There are certainly still some gaps, and I think in terms of care provision, we probably still need more physicians. What we do need to do is expand our hours, and the limitation there is we need other personnel as part of the healthcare team. It's very difficult to find staff to help with the front desk, to find nurses, to find medical office assistants, to find social workers. So the kind of personnel that right now, for example, in our clinic, we don't have anybody but physicians running the clinic. They do everything in the clinic because we haven't been able to find anyone else to work. Though they love it, it does, because it's a training clinic, it prevents us from some of the other creative evening hours and things we want to do. And it's a similar story for other safety net clinics as well. And there's sort of two other major areas that we really see problems for patients, and that is mental health. There's a severe shortage of mental health services and after-hours mental health services and psychiatric beds. There's a fair number of chronically mentally ill people who have returned to the city, and we just don't have the resources to accommodate them. And so we're doing that a lot in primary care, but it's not really our training area. And then we certainly have a need for diagnostic and secondary services, which was mentioned in the video also, that it's fine if you can come in and have your skin condition taken care of or something acute. And I believe that you can pretty much get that done in the city, but you're not really able to get evidence-based care for the kinds of things that for diagnostic tests for diabetes, for example, or for heart failure, things that are evidence-based and expected. And that, I think, blends into the problems we're starting to see with preventive care. We're a year out, and people just are not getting the preventive care they need. They're not getting routine things that we all sort of take for granted, whether it's dental care, eye care, mammography, any other parameters of women's health. And that can only obviously go on for so long until there's a public health impact from that. So with that, I'm going to turn it back to Diane.
Thank you. And I think Dr. Dost is going to give us some insights into the long-term care issues that are facing the city and the population.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming. It's not every day that you get to address a group of this size about the needs of long-term care residents, so I greatly appreciate the opportunity. My colleagues and I recently completed a project funded by the Kaiser Family Foundation to assess the effects of the hurricanes on the long-term care community in and around the New Orleans area. During the months of May, June, and July, we conducted 30-minute telephone interviews with about 20 nursing home administrative directors in and around the hardest-hit areas of the state. These telephone interviews were then followed up with a focus group that was conducted in New Orleans last month, in which a handful of the administrators were actually asked to come up with solutions to some of the problems that had been identified by the hurricanes. During the next couple of minutes, I'd like to outline some of the key findings from our interviews. In some cases, I'll illustrate these points with direct quotes from the administrators. Point number one that I'd like to address is that in each and every interview we conducted, and that's every interview, administrative directors in New Orleans nursing homes felt that they had been left behind by the system. That's not necessarily uncommon to New Orleans. If you talk to administrative directors in other areas of the country, they'd probably say the same thing. As one administrator told me at the conclusion of a focus group, if you get nothing else from this, know that we are on our own when it comes to future evacuations. Administrators pointed to numerous examples of episodes where this has taken place in terms of emergency planning. For example, after Hurricane Ivan, a group of 12 administrators approached their local parish's emergency preparedness office to ask for a meeting. They were refused in writing about three or four times. At a recent meeting post-Katrina, actually, conducted by the Louisiana Nursing Home Association, representatives from the state reportedly notified administrators that they were on their own, and that they needed to understand that the elderly were not a priority in future evacuations. To conclude this point, I'd like to quote one administrator from a recent focus group. When asked what changes he had made to his evacuation plan, he noted in jest that, "I'm going to dress all my residents in prison garb and issue them a dog because they'll get more support following the next hurricane." The second point I'd like to raise, actually, and here I'll paraphrase Shakespeare, is to evacuate or not to evacuate. That is the question. And it's not a question that we have an answer for right now. It's clear that some nursing homes, obviously those in low-laying areas and in cases where the storms coming in are truly severe, need to evacuate. But what people need to understand is that nursing home residents represent the frailest of all populations. Many nursing homes obviously have patients with significant dementia who cannot speak or even follow simple directions. Others have hearing or vision loss. Some are on dialysis. Some have orthopedic injuries that make it very difficult for them to transport. I want all of you to look around the room or look at the person next to you and imagine what it would be like to lift that person and their chair into a school bus. Now I want you to think about the size of this room and realize that it's probably comparable to the size of an average nursing home, and there are four or five of you who need to do this. That's the task that was confronting people in terms of evacuation. In some cases, local communities came to the rescue. In other cases, as we found out, they didn't. I also want to emphasize that while we heard about the tragic events at St. Rita's in St. Bernard Parish, we did not hear about the individual casualties that occurred from evacuations at the area facilities. Most of the administrators we interviewed actually mentioned that they had suffered casualties during their evacuations. In a recent study conducted by one of my collaborators, Dr. Vince Moore at Bryan University, he found that when people evacuated in Louisiana, they actually evacuated to facilities that on aggregate were worse than the ones that they had come to. Now, understand also that these patients were taken care of oftentimes without their medications or without any knowledge of their medical background by physicians in these facilities. So I'd like to close this point by suggesting that we really don't know whether evacuating or not evacuating is the best option, and more studies really need to be done to evaluate this. Our general feeling from these interviews and from those administrators on the ground is that that actually a partial plan of evacuation in the future is probably the best notion, evacuating those that are truly severe at an early date to hospitals outside of the area. This tactic, however, does require more sophisticated means to find out where these patients are and to have public health infrastructure assist in that process. It's also clear to me that we absolutely have to avoid hysterical evacuations. The average administrator felt that they were going to be evacuated 3 to 4 times this coming year. On average, these people had evacuated every other year prior to that. So the last point that I'd like to make is that we really do need better accountability on a local, state, and federal level. Administrative directors at Louisiana nursing homes told us stories of local hospitals shutting the doors on nursing home residents both before and after the storm. Those patients were on dialysis. They also told us stories of buses contracted to the nursing homes being directed by public officials to the local jails to evacuate prisoners prior to nursing home residents. These are things that potentially can be fixed on a community and local level. And what I can tell you from these interviews is that the communities that had these types of local infrastructure prior did better than those that did not. The other great fear this year is the question of where residents will go during the next complex emergency. There are nursing home administrators that are waiting to be paid still for residents that have been in their facilities since the fall. This has to do with the Medicaid systems and problems with reimbursement. This also occurs when residents go across state lines, for example, those residents leaving Louisiana and going to Texas. There are some administrators who estimate that they're still waiting on 20% of their payments for residents. So this is really a clear problem. It's also important to know that there are many nursing homes who received evacuees after the last hurricane who are now saying that they won't do it again for exactly this reason. Remember, these are private institutions for the most part. And while they're held to that standard in terms of evacuating, meaning that they are on their own, They also may feel that way when they're asked to receive patients in the next catastrophe that we face. Finally, and I think that this may come up again, there's the issue of tort reform. With rare exceptions, nursing homes provided incredible care under situations that were truly disastrous. In fact, the healthcare system really disintegrated around them, as some of the panelists have attested to. Yet when you drive down the streets of New Orleans now, one of the only billboards you will actually see as you head in and out of the city are those advertising lawyers looking to sue. This is really something that will affect future evacuations. There are bus companies now that will refuse to evacuate elderly residents. There are at least a handful of them in the Louisiana area because of concerns about being sued. So this is really something that the federal and state governments need to look at, and hopefully it's something that we can discuss at a later time. I'd like to thank you for your attention. Thanks.
Thank you. Dr. Mack, to provide a broader perspective for us at the challenges of primary care.
Thank you. And thank you all for being here today. Pre-Katrina, the Gulf region basically had a significant health disparity issue. We've heard some of the statistics about Louisiana, and we all know that Mississippi was actually at the bottom of the list as far as poverty line and health disparity issues. We've all heard of the Delta. One area that was hit significantly was Bayou La Batrie in Alabama, which was a fishing community. It was basically 50% white America, about 33% Asian American, Asian population. It's a fishing community. So all cultures were hit during Hurricane Katrina. But previous to that, there was a significant health care issue. Then Hurricane Katrina and Rita came. Hurricane Katrina, as you know, impacted the U.S. economy to the tune of $1 billion. There have been about 800,000 deaths so far. I think about 1,600 out of New Orleans, Louisiana itself. Another 200 or 230 in Mississippi. I don't think there were any in Alabama that we know of. But it tells you the significant impact of the hurricane. There were 189,000 children who were evacuated. And a study at LSU talked about, done on 5,000 children, stated that 96% of those children witnessed the destruction or the damage of their communities. 14% witnessed the death of a relative. And another 36% were separated from their caregiver at one point. So this shows the significant impact. The film today put a face on it. The truth is, we look at communities and we speak of communities, but a lot of times we don't put faces on the victims of Hurricane Katrina. What we're trying to do at this point is we're trying to put systems in place. At Morehouse, we received some funding from NIH and OMH to develop a program with the mission of trying to help rebuild, to work with and partner with those in the area, and some of them around the table today, to help rebuild, expand upon the healthcare system by developing projects around at least five objectives. And those objectives are electronic health record, to try to upgrade those systems. As you know, a lot of paper records were damaged. People were evacuated to cities like Atlanta, Houston, Mobile, D.C., New York, without any medical records, not knowing the medications, what the allergies were. Telemedicine is one of the key services that we're trying to provide in technologies. Dr. Kim is here today. He's working with us on that. What we'd like to do is put telemedicine in place in remote areas, but also in those communities that don't have mental health, and try to provide services of mental health and pipe it into those communities. Screening and surveillance, and also research. We're mandated to work with the academic centers through Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, and even in Louisiana. We I can tell you about the export centers later, but LSU and Tulane, there's not a formal export center in Louisiana, but we're also mandated to work with those centers to try to provide research that will help identify issues within the communities that we can in turn come back and try to patch up and decrease the health disparities. Balanced health care is another, to try to balance the health care field where people who are underserved and don't have the wherewithal to try to seek service and pay for services can seek one day in this country the same, have the same access to health care as those who have the finances or the ability to seek those services. So overall, what we like to do is try to and work with our partners to try to put a healthcare infrastructure in place that is readily responsive to any disasters such as Hurricane Katrina, Rita, etc., but also responds to the daily needs of the underserved populations. Now, that's an initiative that we have at Morehouse, but one thing I like to say, and you heard our friends from LSU and the things that they're dealing with. No one knows the hurt and the impact on an individual patient, and no one knows the impact on the health system, the providers within LSU, Mississippi, that are actually doing the work. We can't come in from the outside and do the work any better, and we don't know the impact. One thing we're seeing during this disaster is a lot of time there's a lot of acute care within the community. People fly in, and that's patchwork, as you heard on the video, and that's what we need at the time. But it's basically a separate system from the system which traditionally works within that community, and it has no effect on the system within that community. So once those physicians providers fly out, the system still has to deal with its issues. And this also goes down to the community level. If you don't know the community you're dealing with, the cultural issues that go on in that community, it's no way to affect it. So in order for us to correct the problems that we have now in healthcare, we are going to have to work long-term with the health systems and also with the communities to affect the system. So basically, I know we're going to have a time of questions and we're going to be able to explain ourselves further, but I'd just like to say that. Thank you.
Thank you. And Erwin.
Thanks. And I will also add my thanks to the Kaiser Family Foundation. I actually wanted to say that this is great, and we need to express our gratitude for what you've been doing around this, but also in the larger sense, your contributions to our understanding of the healthcare issues and needs in the United States for a really long time now has been just spectacular. I don't know what we would have done without you over these years. So just that, thanks. And the second thing I'd like to say is that there are a lot of very, very difficult challenges and difficult stories out of this disaster, and I have plenty of my own, and I'll give you a hint of that. But I also want to say that the amount of heroism that we saw in the Gulf from August 29th through this present time is rather extraordinary also. And people persisting under conditions that would be almost intolerable for most people. And two of those heroes are sitting up on this podium in Karen and in Fred. And I just wanted to say to them and for the people that they represent in those badly, badly impacted states that we all take our hats off to you. You've done an extraordinary job under very difficult situation. The difficulty of the situation, let me start by saying this, is a series of unprecedented realities that have happened in the Gulf, and some of them have been referred to already. But just to understand this, I did some work after Hurricane Andrew, 1992, in South Florida. It was a Category 5, very damaging storm, affected about 300 square miles of South Florida. This storm affected nearly 100,000 square miles from Alabama through Mississippi and Louisiana. And the extent of this and the damage to the infrastructure represent itself a very, very complex mega disaster for which we don't have a whole lot of experience in managing either in the immediate relief sense or in the long-term recovery, as we're now we're really witnessing firsthand here. This is a horribly complex, difficult task. And the other piece of the unprecedented reality here is the number of people who are displaced and the disruptions of systems to serve those people. Really, not since the Dust Bowl in the 1930s have so many Americans been displaced from their communities because of events that they had no control over. And this reality, coupled with the amount of damage that we've seen, pose some challenges, again, that really are have no precedent in modern American history. Operation Assist was a program that we created by combining the assets of two organizations immediately in the aftermath, within a few days of the storms. And the two organizations are the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, and the second is something called the Children's Health Fund, which is a 501c3 organization that for the last 20 years is providing health care to medically underserved children and families throughout the United States. And as of August 28th, I guess we had about 17 programs nationally in rural and urban areas using mobile medical units and other ways of getting to people who are hard to reach. In the aftermath of the storm, Operation Assist actually deployed several of its mobile units and many of its medical teams down to the Gulf in Gulfport, Biloxi, in the Baton Rouge area, and New Orleans, and other parts of Louisiana. And we've been there ever since. And in the intervening times, we've raised sufficient funds that we've now been able to provide permanent programs in partnerships with Tulane, LSU, and other institutions in Mississippi. But basically, we recognize what Dominic was just talking about, and that is that the immediate providers who come into an area, whether it's after 9/11 in New York City or Andrew in Florida or the tsunami in Indonesia or this situation, they have an effect and save lives, but they really don't affect the long-term infrastructure stability. Cognizant of that, we intended from the beginning to establish permanent partnerships and leave permanent programs here, which we're in the process of doing, and that's all transpiring. We've seen about 15,000 people since the storm, and again, is that a big number or a small number? It's really a tiny number, and it reflects one of the points I want to make, which has to do with the fact that in really big situations, in mega disasters, private organizations, the NGOs, have an important role to play. But the reality is that they have to be scaled up. They have to have fully engaged governmental partnerships where the resources really are to fix things for the long term. This is one of the most important lessons we can take out of this. You know, one of my favorite not-for-profits is Habitat for Humanity builds houses. They build hundreds of houses. Well, when you need tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of houses to be built, that is a job not for not-for-profits, certainly not for not-for-profits alone, but those entities in collaboration with government, and hopefully that's needless to say. Operation Assist, in addition to its clinical programs, has been providing a number of public health services, including surveys that we've done in the field. We have some information about those, some of those outside the room here that just came by FedEx while you're in here, I think. But they're available for you to pick up a copy of. But we've gone door-to-door in some of the FEMA trailer parks and tried to get a handle on some of the conditions and issues that are facing families in this aftermath. The deal for me is that this is not just a question of the breakdown of medical services and people in a static way not having the ability to access primary care or specialty services. But what happens in a situation like this is that the ongoing medical needs just continue to exacerbate, that the people who were mildly out of control with a chronic illness 4 months ago are now moderately or severely out of control with respect to asthma, diabetes, heart disease, and all those other things. So the problems are not a static photograph, but they're an ongoing video that continues to deteriorate over time. And time is an issue that is one of the things I just wanted to focus on, because one of the most damaging outcomes of this situation is in the mental health arena. Not only are the resources limited, but the problems are growing. Every single day they're growing. And they're growing not just for the citizens affected by Katrina, but for the providers of those citizens and the officials in those states. And I've met many people who desperately need a break from what they're doing. I used to run pediatric intensive care units, and if I had staff that were in the conditions that many of the doctors and nurses are, and of public officials in Louisiana and Mississippi, I would send them home on a mandatory vacation for a couple of weeks. These folks are not able to take those vacations. They are stressed to the limit. So the patients and the providers are in the process of experiencing one of the most dramatic mental health impacts that we have ever seen in our country. And this is not going to get better anytime soon. And one of the realities of it, and the problem is here, on top of everything else, is that the uncertainty factor is devastating. Because if you have a big tornado in the Midwest and it destroys a community, you're grieving and you're mourning and you're saying to people, this was horrible, but in a few months it'll be better. We will rebuild. We'll move you somewhere else, and we'll develop a new normalcy. When you tell people when people in a FEMA trailer park camp or whatever what do they call these things?
Village.
I see. Okay. Euphemisms. Gotta love them. Okay. You speak to somebody who's living in the FEMA trailer village in, 270 square feet with their two or three children, and they say, when is it going to get better? The answer is, I don't know. And that is extraordinarily damaging for people trying to recover. There's not much that we can do about that except understand that, because the process is going to take 5 or 7 or 10 years in some circumstances to really fix. In the meantime, we really do, and this, I guess, my main message, have to worry about the immediate needs of people who are currently in the system. We must do the long-term planning, but we really have to appreciate and deal with some of these immediate needs. And I wrote an op-ed a few weeks ago and said that the situation that we now see with the children of Louisiana and some in Mississippi is probably the worst acute child health crisis that we have seen in modern American history, period. We've never had so many displaced children. Our studies show that 20 or 25% of the kids in the FEMA villages are not going to school enough and will probably have to repeat years. The social, educational, and medical and mental health damage to these kids is just extraordinary. So I would leave you with a sense of the enormity of, not that you needed to hear more emphasis of this point, but the fact is that the enormity of the planning needs is equaled by the enormity of the immediate needs. And that is my biggest concern right now as somebody who's been a little bit involved in what's going on in the Gulf. I will conclude with the four big challenges that I see. One is the reconstruction of the healthcare system. And as Karen and Fred has pointed out and others on the panel, this needs to be an entirely different system. The centralized old charity vision of everybody come to the big hospital is old news. New news is distributed community access to health care, which must happen. Along with that, it doesn't mean anything to have only access to primary care if the population is overrun with chronic illnesses needing specialty care. You need access to the whole system. Where are we going to get the specialists that Fred was talking about that need to be there when patients need them? The third thing is that the issue of the mental health and the post-traumatic stress disorder, which we already see and we'll be seeing much more of, has to be dealt with. This is a national emergency. They're not going to produce enough mental health professionals in Louisiana to deal with this problem, and we have to find some national solutions to bring people in to help people cope with this. And the final thing is, unfortunately, in the midst of all this, we also have to be a lot better prepared for the next disaster than we currently are or we were last year. We don't get any time here. We don't get any time off in the planning for disasters. And hopefully we'll get through this hurricane season, but maybe we won't. Hopefully there's enough resources and energy in the state. I don't know how they would possibly do this, but we need a whole lot of thinking about what we do, not only the next hurricane disaster, but pandemic flu and all the other things that people around the rest of the country are working on as well. So a lot of work to do, but I end this hopefully because of the heroism that I talked about before, because of the innovation and the ingenuity of ourselves and our fellow citizens. I do think this is soluble, but we have to keep the pressure up and keep the pressure on, and at the end of the day, I think we'll get done what needs to get done.
Well, Fred, I don't know. Erwin seems to think you need a vacation, but you don't have any ability to take a vacation because you have too much work to do. And I wonder if you could really comment on the challenge for the health care of children and what can be done immediately and in the long run, because we do know there are real gaps and shortages there.
Well, I think Erwin, he's probably been as involved in this as anyone, and is really touched upon it. Kids are going back to school now. There are resources that have to be deployed and will be deployed in schools to deal with this. You all are doing an extensive amount of training. As Erwin said, we don't have the number of providers who are familiar with dealing with these issues that pre-existed in the state, and so there's been a big effort to try to do that training through Columbia, through Tulane, and others, trying to train people who are not your typical mental health providers, but people in schools that are going to be interacting with these children as they come back to school this month, and so it truly does call out for sort of a different way of thinking and how to address these problems, because I think the key point is when we've been able to secure funds to direct toward a problem, and you find yourself in a situation like we did, where we had one community that said, okay, here's your dollars, go address your problem. They said, well, I can't hire 80 social workers. I mean, we just don't have 80 social workers here ready to take a job to go do this work. And so at the same time, we're trying to address problems. We're trying to build capacity at the same time. It's just it's just a tough, complex place to be.
And Karen, what on the ground in terms of trying to provide for some of the mental health gaps? You mentioned the co-location now of mental health services, but everywhere in New Orleans you hear about not only the effect of the hurricane in terms of post-traumatic stress, but the underlying mental health problems that many had before the hurricane that have gotten worse.
Yeah, especially in the medically underserved populations, as people are underserved generally in other areas of their life as well. And so they have such fewer coping skills than people who are insured. And so in those safety net clinics, you know, obviously it becomes a problem of all of their health. It's not just that they're depressed or that they're anxious. It's that because they're depressed and anxious and they have other issues like dealing with their homes or trying to find a place to live, et cetera, that they're not attending to their chronic health issues. And so they're, even if they are coming to clinic, the compliance is down, et cetera. We are, as a community, working together to do what we can do to make sure that we destigmatize mental health care, and because that becomes incredibly important so people don't avoid seeking that care. We're encouraging them to see their whatever resources they feel comfortable with, including faith-based resources. We're trying to sponsor group therapy sessions. We're giving sessions on health and stress coping skills for folks. Working with some health educator programs to really just try to transfer skills to folks who are sort of on the edge, but keep them from tipping over. But really, the people who have had chronic mental illness, who require constant attention, do not have a resource and a place to go. And I'll just say that it was one of the things that we did extremely well at Charity Hospital, was deal with severely mentally ill folks who really didn't have another place to go. And that has been a major problem in the city. We can pick up primary care and some secondary care. We can even pick up trauma. But picking up the sort of great system that we had at Charity, we have not been able to do that for mental health. And I'll be looking forward to that coming back online.
And what's happening to help secure the mental health of the workers who are out there on the front line?
So I'll be going to Erwin's house in the Berkshires for a little while, and then to Drew's. A third of my faculty lost their homes, which is actually a pretty good statistic considering what some other people went through. In the research group that I participate in the School of Public Health, 90% of people lost their homes. And the statistics, for example, at Covenant House, where we started a clinic, 90% of the staff there are homeless. So being homeless, which has a lot of its own issues, is really common in New Orleans right now. And that means that people are doubling up or living in trailers or lacking privacy and hope and security and an understanding of where they're going in the future. And it also means that if I've got a doctor in a room with a patient who's upset, stressed, lost their home, that doctor who's also upset, stressed, and lost their home, that caregiver is not really in a position to be empathetic and giving to the person. And I have had to pull people. And unfortunately, we're pretty thin in the ranks. And so if you pull somebody, there's not really someone to replace it with, and we're under a great deal of pressure to provide care and to do the training and to also begin to build our clinical practice, et cetera. And I, you know, an observation in general about it is that from a leadership standpoint, I don't have the training. I was not trained in how to recognize PTSD, how to recognize people who are at risk, other than what I learned just in general. And I see that that's been a problem at our university. And in fact, we've started some sessions where we're going to be training supervisors and recognizing that, you know, because we also know that this is the 1-year mark where it's problematic. But we don't have a core of medical folks, and I don't think I understood that as a health professional. I sort of had this false impression that, okay, there's a disaster and a bunch of medical people are going to scramble down to Louisiana. They're all perfectly trained and know how to deal with this and work side by side with us until we can get our power back on, and then we'll sort of recreate our health system. And there's really no such thing. Some volunteers come in for a week or two, and they're very helpful, and we appreciate that. But the truth is that they're, by the time we get them sort of oriented to all the different places that you can refer patients, et cetera, they're gone. And I think especially after the many months, there's no, now that there's not an emergency declaration and people can't just come volunteer and do care, we are really in a situation where people need a break and there's no backup. There's no break to get. And I don't have a good answer for that, except that we should think about that as a country, because we were all pretty jazzed up in the first few weeks to go down there and get to work and do the right thing. But we did need a break, and we still do, I think. But we don't know. We know that there is nobody to fill in the gap.
Dr. Mack, do you want to comment on how, in future disasters, we can try and deal with this?
Well, one thing I like to say, I like to refer everyone to the JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association, that came out August the 2nd, and I'd just like to make a comment on the mental health impact. But actually, it was two articles about the tsunami. One was done on a pediatric population, and one was done on adults. And basically, they found a significant prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder and depression on children who were displaced from their village. Basically, it was 13% of those who were affected by the tsunami and remained in the village, it was 11%. And I think for those in the country who weren't affected at all, it was 6%. But what they found, that there were three factors that played a big part, that were factors that were independent factors for developing post-traumatic stress disorder. And they were there was damage, the fear of damage or danger to a relative. One was delayed evacuation. That's the one I'm about to forget. But delayed evacuation, one, and also the fear of panic and just feeling terrified. The same things that we noted that happened in New Orleans to a number of the, not just the pediatric population, and in adults. In the adult population, which also was a fisher, the major industry was fishing, basically the prominent factor for adults was the loss of livelihood. So basically, therapeutic intervention seems to be a way for treatment for the pediatric population. But for the adults, just getting them back to a sense of normalcy. And I would like to say that trying to affect the health care of a community such as this is more than just putting in clinics and building the healthcare system. It's building the infrastructure and having people to get back to their normal lives. That is very important when it comes to mental health. If you don't have a house, you no longer have a job, and you don't have insurance, it's hard to just come into a clinic and expect that we can treat that person back to wellness. So we have to look at the whole structure. But again, one of the things we're looking at the Regional Coordinating Center for Hurricane Response at Morehouse, and we do have a brochure out there also, that you can read about the program, is the telemedicine that we're doing with Dr. Kim from Johns Hopkins. We're working with Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson, who's helping us advise from Oregon State University. But we also have partners. We've met with some of Irwin's folks down in Baton Rouge, and we've worked with the Katrina Coalition, the American Psychiatric Association, to try to develop telemedicine services where we have providers who can provide services into these communities that don't have mental health. One of the prominent issues, and I'll just leave this on the table, is policy. Policy, insurance reimbursement is paramount. As you know, the state of Louisiana, Karen and Fred can tell you more about this, but for a short period, and Louisiana is just an example, but for a short period, outside physicians could provide services within the state, I think up to the month of February, if I'm correct. But outside of that, there's still an emergency in Louisiana, in New Orleans, Mississippi, and there are no laws, state laws, to provide for physicians outside of the state to come in and provide services. The same issues we're dealing with telemedicine, to get providers who don't have licenses from outside the state to provide services within the state. So there needs to be policy changes and also insurance reimbursement, better reimbursement for mental health services, and also for telemedicine. So these are some of the issues we have to work on at a broader level. Thank you.
Right.
We're just whispering here. There's actually a couple of things, because credentialing was a big issue with a flood of volunteers. How do you appropriately credential to make sure that people are who they say they are when they show up to help, and which is a big issue, and but also how you can utilize this this force of volunteers that's at the disposal. And so we have done a few things with that. First of all, executive order of the governor did create some flexibility in doing some rapid credentialing, and then this past legislative session we actually had a law pass that made it easier for the Board of Medical Examiners to be able to streamline some of their processes so that they can do some quick verification of credentials and put people to work who want to help.
And we've looked at the children's issues, but obviously, Dr. Dose, as you raised, those in nursing homes raise one really complex issue of who do you evacuate, when do you evacuate, and how do you do it. Yet we also heard from some of the survivors about individuals in the community who were very disabled, needed a lot of assistance. How do you try and protect the most vulnerable in the community as well as those in nursing homes?
Well, I think that's a very challenging issue, and it sort of boils down to the fact that home care in this country is really related around acute events and not so much for dealing with chronic diseases. So it's challenging. There is a home care infrastructure. That home care infrastructure is regulated to some degree similarly to the nursing home industry. So when somebody is in the system, so to speak, you can identify where they are. Not necessarily now with our current means, but one can envision a system where that could be possible. The difficulty really, though, is that a lot of these people are not identified by the system, and they're the ones who live in their houses, whose diabetes goes out of control, and who's has trouble walking. These are patients sometimes that have bariatric issues, weight issues that prevent them from getting in and out of the house. So I think we're dealing with problems that we see actually everywhere. They're just seemingly magnified in the setting of this mega disaster that we've been talking about.
Karen?
Yeah, this is one of those this issue is one of those oh moments that I had about a million of them since the storm, where I went, oh, I'm such an idiot, why didn't I think about that? But that we've learned from social service agencies exactly what you say, and it's so terrible to think about, but there's all these people with chronic illness who are homebound or who have very limited resources that in the health system, when we think about evacuating, we think about hospitals, you know, and sort of places like that, and we don't think about all the people that are chronically ill. And so what we've been working on in New Orleans is related to this sort of creating the partnerships piece, and that is social service organizations now merging and talking with the health organizations that used to be sort of more distinct. And we now, all, because we're co-located, sometimes we also now participate in regular meetings where we communicate and have organized emergency plans so that people don't get left behind and forgotten about. I'm not saying it's perfect, but it has the awareness certainly has reached the ground that there's got to be a better way.
I think that it's clear that planning for evacuations is something that unfortunately those in the Gulf states are going to have to continue to be able to do. I think some of the lessons you've heard this morning from Katrina are that there's lots of people who get left behind unless you think through how to organize it and do it. We've heard a lot about the stress and strain on the healthcare providers who are there and on ways of bringing in additional resources. And we've clearly been hearing a great deal about the challenges of taking care of the population that is there in terms of both their ongoing healthcare needs and the new ones created by the displacement from the hurricane. You've been a patient audience so far, but I know you probably have questions you would like to pose to our speakers, so if you would please raise your hand, identify yourself, and pose your question, that would be great. We have microphones that will find you if you raise your hand.
Sure. Hi, I'm Bill Borwig, and I'm with the Service Employees International Union. We represent 1.8 million workers, and half of them are healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, mental health workers, the whole range of different people that could really be providing additional assistance to our folks in Louisiana that are trying to deal with a horrendous situation. Last year, we tried to send people down there. We actually ended up sending over down over 100 nurses and mental health workers, dropping the bucket, I guess. You know, we tried to work through the HHS system. We registered literally hundreds of over 500 nurses. None of them are ever called, you know, through that system. I don't know whatever happened to that system where they apparently the federal government registered 40,000 healthcare workers to help in these kind of situations. The bottom line is we want to redeploy our folks within the next month. We're going to be meeting people from our office. Are going to be meeting with Dr. Cerise. We're also going to be meeting this afternoon with people from International Medical Corps, which I believe are in the room somewhere, and to see if we can partner with them. But we're anxious to work with whoever wants to work with us to try to send our nurses who are eager to go down there, nurses, doctors, other, like I said, mental health professionals, to continue to contribute. One of the issues is the licensure issue, which we need to deal with, and I understand, you know, hopefully we're going to make some progress with that. So, you know, with that, you know, we're partnering with the former CEO of Cook County Hospital, who's also helping. We're interested in not only going down there and spending the couple weeks like you talked about, but to really spend more time to send people down for six weeks to 6 months, really, and not only to provide immediate medical care, but to really be involved in rebuilding the healthcare system so that we have a better healthcare system for the residents of New Orleans. So,
thank you.
I guess it's not really a question, except to, you know, if you want to, whoever's interested in partnering with us, we want to partner with you. We have many thousands of healthcare workers who want to volunteer, and we just need to figure out how to place them. It's hard. You know, we did it last time. It's, you know, housing. Back then, we couldn't get rental cars. I think we probably have solved that problem by now. But, you know, just these fairly basic needs that people have that want to go down and volunteer, we have their services, but we just have to figure out how to place them. So,
thank you.
Hi, I'm Claudia Schlossberg. I'm with Blank Room Government Relations. I've been in health policy here in Washington for a while. I've been listening very, very carefully. I've been down to New Orleans a couple of times since last August, and You know, I appreciate everything that you've said. I've been listening very carefully since 10 o'clock, and not one of you has mentioned the role of the federal government. So I need to pose this question. What has been the role of the federal government? What has our federal government been doing, and what should they be doing, and what should we here in the Washington community be asking our federal government do for you?
You want it, Fred?
Well, I'm looking at everybody else here. let me say, because it's I think we certainly have all learned many lessons here. And I think what we're dealing with is of such magnitude that we're all just presented with unprecedented situations. And so with that as a preface, there are a lot of things we can point to that have not worked well and that didn't work well. You asked about what the role of the federal government is and how they've been interacting. I guess I can tell you how they've been interacting with us. And there are pieces of support that have worked well. When we have received block grant funds to be able to deploy, that has worked well. And it's not only federal government, it's also state government and sort of getting those funds out, because there's this immense tension with anything that comes in. Everybody's looking to Louisiana to see how you're going to waste these dollars and, who's going to make off with the money. And so, you know, at the state level, there are layers of accountability that have been put in place. And quite frankly, that's delayed some of the getting the dollars out on the street. And then there's the issues of kind of this, like I described earlier, the workforce issues of getting dollars out on the street. And so I'll say... there have been a number of areas where we actually have worked well with our federal partners. We have ongoing efforts right now, I think, certainly down the road and rebuilding. You've probably read and seen Secretary Leavitt has shown a great interest in trying to see how he can help influence in the longer term as things come back, delivery systems that come back in a more sensible, rational way. In the short term, you know, we received relief from Congress in Medicaid to be able to avoid cuts in the program. That was kind of status quo that kept us from having to cut providers in the middle of all of this stuff in January. We actually, as a state, had put forward 10% across the board cuts in our Medicaid program before we received that congressional relief. So we have gotten some significant relief. In the Medicaid program, it is time limited. We did not have all of the flexibility we could use with some of that, although, you know, there were ways that we have been able to address some of the uncompensated care funds that we needed for institutions. We didn't have that same flexibility with physicians, which is a problem building our workforce. So, I don't want to give the idea that, particularly in the healthcare area, you know, we've been out there on our own trying to do this. We have had lots of conversations and partnerships along the way. Certainly, like I said, we've all learned some lessons of things we would do differently, and having kind of greater flexibility with the way that relief is provided. Speed and flexibility are probably the two things, the biggest things we could learn from this.
Flexibility, which is would be extremely important in terms of timelines, because it takes 10 times as long to get anything done as you think it's going to be down there, et cetera. I will say on a positive note that the Public Health Service had folks on the ground right away who helped us in not only restoring services, 911, medical control, getting some hospitals to stand up, evacuate patients, and they helped because they bring their communication systems and their sort of organizational skill sets, and that was irreplaceable early after the storm. And the really good news, I hope it's still the same good news, is that one of the
the people who was leading that, a guy named Vince Berkeley, has been redeployed to be down again this summer so that he knows the lay of the land and all the people, and I hope that hasn't changed. And so that kind of continuity will make a big difference, and in having that sort of backbone of someone to coordinate efforts who is external meant an awful lot. And they helped actually get the ground-level strategic planning going back in early October and pulled together stakeholders so we could begin talking about the new vision for healthcare that's now moving forward in a collaborative. And so those kinds of efforts really help because they're not thinking about, you know, their house and whether they can get the contractor out there to build it. The military was also extraordinarily helpful. I would have never thought I wanted the military in my state before the storm, but I have changed my tune about that. They bring with them amazing resources. They can build 100,000 houses. They can build a bridge. They can do things pretty quickly that can restore services and prevent you from having to think about it. You know, they sort of open a box and a dental clinic appears. And it's really it's a wonderful resource. And so as long as we had them there more, and it was much more helpful, and I wish they could have stayed longer.
Dr. Back and then Dr.
I don't think I'd disappear if I mentioned FEMA. But, I mean, that story has been beat down. But I'd like to say we're federally funded. I think in a lot of instances, the government basically depends on others to manage the funds. And sometimes there's bad management. But at the Morehouse School of Medicine, we were basically funded because I think they knew we were culturally sensitive. The work we had done previously with health disparities, with Dr. Satcher. So basically we've received those funds. Some of the things we were able to do in New Orleans and Baton Rouge, we worked with X-Health Community Health Center, which was displaced. We worked with the New Orleans Health Department. You may have heard about the event at the Audubon Zoo. We had public-private partnerships with Intel at American Academy of Family Physicians, Sarventis, the New Orleans Health Department. LSU was there, Tulane was there, University of Tennessee was there, Southern University, Xavier. So we've also been able to work with St. Thomas Community Health Center. We're hopefully about to put an electronic health record in place in that community health center, which is in New Orleans. And also, I keep mentioning Dr. Kim, I'm trying to keep him working, but he's been working with LSU and Tulane to try to implement a telemedicine unit within the city of New Orleans. So I just like to say, I think the federal government has worked two ways. One, that they've been visible, of course, with FEMA as far as like their responsibilities, and of course everyone has their opinion, but also they've relied on other institutions such as us to try to implement some of the corrective operations.
Well, our public opinion poll clearly shows the public doesn't think the federal government did enough. And Irwin, what more could they have done?
Oh, where can I begin? This is a critical question that you asked, and the reality is that the federal government has a wide range of roles in the planning for, immediate response to, and recovery from mega disasters. And I want to distinguish that mega disaster from typical disasters that are normally handled locally or by states or regions. In a situation like this, a lot of the debacle that we witnessed after the hurricane struck had to do with some fundamental problems in the federal government's ability to plan and to operationalize plans. And the FEMA was just sort of the first phase of our understanding of how deeply flawed the federal government's approach to mega disaster planning response actually is. And actually, we're now watching the unfolding of the pandemic plans, which have similar issues with them that I'm sort of seeing this now prospectively and don't like what I'm seeing. But the fact of the matter is that we have to, first of all, re-examine the role of the federal government. What exactly are they supposed to be doing, and how should they be doing it? So the issues that Fred needs them to perform on, which has to do with with waivers and support and money, they have to get that to happen much more quickly and much more effectively so that Fred can have the resources in his hands much faster than it's currently happening. Second of all, not only did they screw up the FEMA, the initial response, but the management of the displaced people in these FEMA disasters is disgraceful. They should be out of that business. They are not acceptable conditions for children and families. I have no idea why that's not being run by Louisiana officials, for somehow that the feds have decided to hold on through their Halliburton contracts and subcontractors. It's a mess, and it's a disgrace, and we have to fix that. FEMA itself has to be restructured. The Lieberman-Collins bill right now will go a long way to do that. It'll help refocus how FEMA functions and who it reports to and when it reports to. We have to fix the way the military is engaged before these events happen. The relationships that make the military most effective happen when those relationships between the military and local officials are long-time, I know you, you know me relationships. So when the thing happens, they're ready to go. How we bring in the military, when we bring them in, how long we keep them there, and what they do are all things that need the attention of Congress. And the other thing is here's a little sidebar for you. I think we really need, on the federal level, to reexamine the charter of the American Red Cross, which, as far as I'm concerned, and I know people have different views of it, was itself a very, very unsatisfactory response to this big disaster. Now, it's true enough that this was so big that it was just too big in some ways for anybody to handle. But we really have to look at what the federal government expects in the charter relationship with the Red Cross and see if we can deal with that. And the final thing is that we have to keep the attention of the Congress focused on this issue. And I know Americans in your survey are focused. The question is, will the Congress and the large federal agencies remain as focused as the American people seem to be in it? And I think that's still up for grabs.
I'm Stuart Gordon, National Association of Chain Drugstores, and given what we've just heard, I have to say it's a little puzzling. There's nobody up there from DHS or DHHS, and I hope Kaiser has a follow-up panel plan to have those officials answer some of the questions that were raised today.
We did invite Secretary Leavitt to be with us this morning, but he was unable to attend.
I suspected that might be so. I suspect you didn't hear it all from FEMA. The pharmacy industry, like the nursing home industry, found itself unreimbursed for the services and products it provided post-Katrina to the tune of about $10 million. Claims started being paid last month in Louisiana. That's an observation. The question is, separate question is, I understand you're all working on electronic health records, and that's very important. But I recall that power was out for weeks post-Katrina, and I'm wondering what you're doing about backup systems.
I can start with that. I can't speak with everyone, but or for every industry, but certainly in the nursing home industry, there have been some improvements and tangible improvements in terms of emergency planning, issues of generators, for example, issues of supplies, those types of things have improved. Old plans used to call for these industries to have 3 days of supplies on hand. When you actually test how long a supply goes, most of the time you underestimate by about 50%. So, for example, some of the administrators told us that, you know, diapers that were supposed to last for 3 days ended up lasting for a day. From a perspective of how people have planned, there is a little bit more in terms of now people have 10-day supplies, for example. Generators at some of these facilities are starting to be upgraded so that they'll be able to run air conditioning units and certainly computers for medical records. The other issues really, though, from a reimbursement perspective are federal issues to some degree. And I think one of the big things that that the federal government can be involved with is disasters that cross state lines. And with these mega disasters that involve Mississippi and New Orleans and Texas, and a lot of patients, a lot of people went from point A to point B. And quite frankly, the government had no idea where they went half of the time. And, you know, these are things that need to be clarified, and we need to have a system in place where we can find out where a resident from, you know, facility X went. There are administrators who are still missing, you know, people that were in their facilities months, you know, we're 11 and a half months after the fact. So these are things that can be done. In terms of payment, I think you're absolutely right. It becomes a very big issue. The pharmaceutical industry, to some degree, wasn't paid. Certainly the nursing homes weren't paid. And these are things where the government can really step in, at least in my opinion.
The pharmaceutical industry really stepped up to the plate in New Orleans. If you're a patient with chronic disease and you needed medication, New Orleans was the place to be in August or September, because you could get any medication that you needed. It was really tremendous. Your question about electronic health records has a two-part answer. One is that our choice on the ground is to use electronic health records that are web-based or are hosted, so the information is not only available locally but also on the internet, so that patients who are displaced will be able to access that information, or providers theoretically will be. That's a little bit further down the road, but that is the general concept. And at the state level, there's federally funded initiatives to create a RIO, a regional health information, I don't know what the O is, organization, and that Fred's office is really leading that effort, so I'm speaking for him. I apologize for that. But it involves providers on the ground in New Orleans and Baton Rouge to create a master patient index, so that there is information available about patients who become displaced. And I know that's the sort of thing that Morehouse is working on. So the thinking is there, and the steps to put the equipment and the implementation in the offices is really important to get done right now, because as we're creating these health clinics, before we've created all these workflows and hired a bunch of other staff, if we put that as part of our infrastructure, just like the floor plan, if you will, then the clinic grows around it, including for the patients. And so that's why there's some urgency to kind of get the information there in the clinic and build that into our new system, so it's the regular way of doing business.
I'm Jim Byrne. I'm editor of Healthcare Disparities Report. And clearly the message here among them is we've created a whole lot more of the disparities population, at least in the short run, to a great extent of people not really having access because they're, you know, physically removed. It sounds like the care is pretty good. I mean, the people who are coming in are probably getting pretty good care. What is the long-run view of what clearly Louisiana and Mississippi had probably some of the worst healthcare disparities situations in the country. In the longer run, are you hopeful that we'll not only catch up, but improve on that?
Well, let me say that's precisely the work that we're trying to balance here in terms of planning for the future. And the tension that you can hear is that there are immediate needs that we have to address today while we are trying to do these plans for the future. But the ideas that Karen has discussed in terms of doing a better job of managing people with chronic disease, having electronic records to be able to understand what we're doing, to provide the decision support, to do the right things, to track what we're doing so that we can measure those types of things. You know, if we don't come out of this with a system that does a better job of having better access, more equitable access, and with greater expectations in terms of performance, so that we don't have the types of disparities that you're talking about, you know, then we've doubly failed. I do think if you look at it, if you look at systems of care that are in place now in the state, those systems tend to do better because you've got systems support, not because one person's smarter than another. And, you know, I think that we've got to just, as we rebuild, look at how we build this network with common set of expectations so that, you know, we don't have disparate systems.
Sure.
Just to follow up on that, as Fred said, you have the systems. One of the key things that I think we have to look at is the interoperability of the medical record and also the systems, the pharmacist talking to the hospital. Now, especially for the underserved patients, we know as much as they go to the emergency room, a record is recreated every time they go to the emergency room, even though they've been there tons of times before. Then they go to the pharmacy, they have to give that information again. The electronic health record helps with that, but also an initiative that we've been pushing is the continuity of care record. The continuity of care record, or the personal health record that some people refer to, is a record that can be placed in the hands of the patient. And the patient can actually carry this on a thumb drive or a CD disc with them in their pocketbook, etc. It's HIPAA compliant, but the other thing, it can be accessed through the web portal. So there are a number of avenues to try to decrease the level of health disparities among the population.
I have one more quick comment, since you are from Health Disparities Report. And what has not been mentioned here today, too, is the Latino population that we have. And it is one of the biggest unknowns for us in terms of planning and in terms of care delivery. We have a system that was, and we have a lot of measures that are really targeted at looking at black-white differences, but the language now differences and the cultural differences for this new population that's there to work and rebuild our city is going to be quite challenging, especially if they're going to stay. We're going to have to do some real serious reconfiguring.
And now the question from the rear.
Hi, my name is Peter Ragusa. I'm a medical student and a fellow here in D.C. I was born and raised in Lake Charles and Lake Charles in New Orleans. So, needless to say, last year was a bit of a tough year. I have three questions, so I'll keep them brief. Dr. Cerisi, as far as the infrastructure rebuilding, knowing that Louisiana has some of the lowest taxes and, of course, decimated tax base in New Orleans, how is that infrastructure going to be funded? Second question goes to liability reform. With the current case, criminal case pending against a number of physicians in New Orleans, what kind of liability reform can be pursued to prevent doctors from having to choose between staying and caring for their patients or facing criminal liability should something come of whatever happens? And third quick question for Dr. Mack, who is the region? Is it hospitals, insurance companies, nursing home facilities, hotels? I mean, when you're coordinating the region, who actually is the region? Who are the players? Thank you.
Well, first, the infrastructure issue. That's we have that will be a multitude of sources essentially that get mixed to address those issues. We've already started with some in terms of block grant funds that have been able to be used. We expect that some of the community development funds will be dedicated to healthcare related infrastructure issues. Will be, you know, part of the work that we're doing with the collaborative. We'll be looking at that kind of what's a rational allocation. Where do you want to direct rebuilding and infrastructure resources? And so I think, you know, that's going to be a combination of state and federal dollars primarily, and you know, some of them been identified, and I'm sure that some of them are yet to be identified. There's no question we're going to need ongoing help in doing that, and people are looking at insurance and FEMA and federal grants and state dollars, and it's going to be that kind of calculation that goes on to address what are the priority infrastructure needs there. In terms of the liability reform, I don't have a good answer for that. There's a very high profile case going on right now. That's it's unusual and unpredictable. And I'm not sure that there's a liability reform law that can be passed to address that particular circumstance. It's just it is generated an immense amount of interest among people who stayed behind, who provided assistance and provided care, and now people are talking about not wanting to do that again because of this. I don't know the details of what happened inside of that hospital, and so it's very difficult to comment. I think that's, again, it's part of this entire episode for that. To have that one very unusual case come up, it's just tough for me to think how to address that from a policy perspective. It's just hopefully we will see a fair and satisfactory resolution of that. But I mean, what you have there are families who are, making complaints, and a district attorney who is responding to that, and a lot of unknowns in between. So, I don't have a good answer for addressing that through liability reform.
Dr. Mack,
the question about the region, basically the center was formed in a response to Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. The region is basically the states of Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, and Texas, with a focus on, of course, the states of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama. So programs have been initiated in each of the states. In the first year of funding, what we've done is try to identify areas that were directly impacted by the hurricanes, and also those places where a significant amount of the evacuees went to, like Houston. And, of course, Florida, where it was also impacted by the hurricane. We hope to expand upon that, and really not to the vision is not for it to just be a response to regional disaster, a response to national disaster, but mostly a response to health disparities. Because we feel that if we respond to the health disparities appropriately, put preventative medicine in place, the infrastructure will be built so that we'll automatically respond to disasters in a timely manner and appropriately.
I'm Peggy Eastman with Emergency Medicine News. It's a Lippincott publication. And my question goes to the electronic health record that a number of you have been talking about. The Institute of Medicine recently recommended that we move in this country to an electronic health record very shortly. So my question really is, do you all think that what you're doing in New Orleans could be
the International Union, IMC, and we are speaking, I think, next week about some of those resources as well. But oftentimes this comes back down to availability of workforce and housing to provide the needed services.
Can I just emphasize that point? One of the big things, particularly with the mental health industry and to some degree to the long-term care industry, is that these industries don't always have problems with staffing. It's not a unique problem to New Orleans or the disaster-hit area. Unfortunately, with people moving out, it's been particularly difficult to get people to work in these environments. And it's not just the doctors and the nurses. It's the LPNs. It's the aides. These are the people who earn kind of minimum wage to work in places. And when they're competing against the McDonald's down the street, which can offer them $2 more per hour plus health benefits, it becomes almost a foregone conclusion that you're going to have staffing issues. Most of the nursing homes, for example, have capability to open beds, but they don't have people to staff those beds. And that's, I think, the same with the hospitals and the mental health facilities.
Yes. What we did, and I'm answering your question, but what we did with the health fair and post health, the health initiative, health recovery week, and post health recovery week, was put the system in place to basically we developed a health record system that could capture the patient information. The data bank is at the health department. We've continued to work with the health department with a number of other initiatives, but the data that was captured at the health recovery week remains at the health department. I'm just saying that to say I know it's been a lot of issues with infrastructure, et cetera, but we continue to push for that information to get into the hands of the patients. And I would like for you to take the message back for them to continue to call the department to request those records.
Good. Okay.
Hi, I'm Josh Fishman. I'm a writer with U.S. News and World Report magazine. And I wanted to ask you about these safety net clinics that a number of you have talked about, Dr. DeSalvo and others, and the move to build a more distributed healthcare system, moving away from the older system based on or centered on charity and university hospitals. What sorts of services are provided in these clinics now? What's the state of this system now, and where would you like to be? Thank you.
Send more money. We, quite seriously, charity is actually part of our safety network. So instead of being mostly the safety network with 300,000 patients they take care of, we're trying to distribute them amongst all of us. And that partially comes from the fact that, frankly, some of us have been there since September providing care for these patients. And so we have established continuity, and now patients are thinking of this as their new home. The system is bound now fiscally through the Social Services Block Grant and through our agent that we've all appointed, which is the Louisiana Public Health Institute. So now the Partners in Access to Healthcare Network is not a single 501c3 or a single entity, but we do have a memorandum of understanding amongst each other so that we are cooperating and working together, and we have regular meetings because people love to meet. We've agreed to share health information. We agree to share other resources like staff. We've agreed to share training opportunities. We share in grants, and we share information about other grants that will come our way. So that is the level at which we've decided to cooperate. One of the hopes for the future is that we will be able to continue the individuality of some of these clinic sites. Some patients would prefer to go to a certain kind of health center versus other folks, and we think choice should be part of that. So we will not have a same franchise stamp on everything, but we'll work together to make sure that there's the same core of quality and safety and information sharing for all the patients. Charity's role in this, in particular, training institutions. So we do still have clinics at Charity. We still train there, and we'll be on the inpatient service when it reopens in the fall, is going to become more of a referral source. So for patients who have more complex illness, so what we see in the community is true primary care, prevention, wellness, education, health teams of which patients are participating to keep themselves well. When the complexity rises and they need more diagnostic studies and more advanced care, then they'll be referred into the core of the system, and that's where we'll have our diagnostic tests done as well.
Hi, my name is Sarah Van Gertruden. I work here at Patton Boggs, and I'm actually from Baton Rouge. So this is very exciting for me to listen to everybody on the panel. One of the things I just wanted to raise is there seems to be, with the exception of Tulane, there seems to be little discussion about the private sector's role in providing a safety net in the New Orleans area and throughout the state, because the private hospitals and private institutions have been, I think, providing a lot of the care to uninsured people who were displaced as well as the ones that stayed in New Orleans. So I guess I was hoping to get some feedback on that, and is the state looking at doing more partnerships with the private sector and doing away with the exclusion under DISH for paying private sector entities?
Always an interesting topic in Louisiana. The
DISH is federal Medicaid payments that Louisiana has been very good in the past at drawing down.
Right. You know, yeah, and so whenever you mention DISH, everybody sort of raises their eyebrows and looks crosswise, yes, at you. But, you know, I take a different approach. I think DISH can be a good thing. You know, we have not always used DISH for the maximum good, but they are flexible dollars. We're fortunate in Louisiana to have a high DISH cap, and I think if you look at what you need, the Medicaid program has some big holes in it in terms of who's eligible for those services, and so to have those more flexible funds available, I think is important, and you can use them to provide the types, everything you've heard up here described, clinic services and systems of care and those types of things, and it does not have to be exclusive to one provider type or another. You know, in the this year, there will be, in fact, $120 million in DISH will be used to create a community hospital pool to pay community hospitals for services that they will do primarily in the absence of charity hospital. I tell you my own personal feelings about DISH and hospitals is that I would prefer not to have that entire chunk of money dedicated to hospital care, where primarily you're going to pay for a lot of unconnected services, you'll pay for a lot of emergency room care and that type of thing. It's a reality today. It's essential that we do that today while we're picking up the pieces. But in the future, I think it would be a smarter use of those funds to fund those kind of clinics that Karen is talking about, to keep people out of those hospital emergency rooms and out of those beds. And I think a more distributed model like that makes a whole lot of sense.
My name is Ruth Perot. I'm the executive director of Summit Health Institute. I want to commend Kaiser for allowing us to hear those voices, and especially the young composer who provided the music. A quick editorial comment. I wonder if it's time after the 60s when we had the Peace Corps for a domestic health corps that allows us to send people where they're needed for a long enough period so they can really be of service. Two questions. Are there any strategies to help some of the providers in the African-American community in New Orleans in particular, who knew the community so well and who lost everything, to return? It would seem to me you would not have the issue of cultural competence. You would not have the learning curve. Second question, many of you talked about electronic medical records. Congress is deliberating on this issue right now. And we think, and we can see the connection, if properly used, between eliminating health disparities and the use of those records. What recommendations would you make to Congress to help them facilitate that connection?
Many of the pre-Katrina physicians of whatever race or ethnicity are in New Orleans, actually. We did lose a lot of physicians. The core of the people that are working there were already participating in the safety network. Just to clarify the cultural competency chasm, there you go, that I see happening is with the Latino and Spanish-speaking community, who is a very complex community, Central, Southern, South American, Mexican. And so that is the area where I am personally trying to recruit, because I don't have really a lot of Spanish-speaking physicians. But in terms of retaining doctors in the area, Fred mentioned sort of payments to clinic, payments to physicians is something we really still haven't seen, and many of us have been working on the hope and the prayer that we're going to keep our jobs. Places like Tulane University and others have continued to pay us, even though as much as 25% to 40% of the care we provide, even in our private practice, is uncompensated care. But we don't know how long we can sustain that as on the ground. And so thinking about ways that we can provide relief for private practice docs as well as employed physicians is still something that we're working on. Erwin?
I just want to make a comment about your editorial comment about a national sort of medical pool. And there is actually a very good program, the National Health Service Corps, and there's some state versions of that. And the idea is that people in medical school, for physicians, say, if they get into the National Service Corps, the National Service Corps pays their tuition, in return for which there's a certain obligatory service in an underserved community, or they will pay back a loan for the same kind of arrangement. The problem is that that program is highly underfunded. And this is something very concrete that I think the Congress could think about, tripling or quadrupling, literally, the National Service Corps, which would actually go a long way. And one of the things that we had recommended was this sort of emergency expansion of the National Service Corps for reasons that are complicated, but the outcome is good. I am sensing a great deal of interest among medical students and nursing students in doing community service. So if the opportunities were available in a more expanded fashion, I think we could, in relatively rapid order, create a much larger pool of people who could actually be assigned to underserved communities. And certainly in an event like this, there would be great need to fill in that way. So I think that's something that could be done, as well as the replication of that program. Does Louisiana have that, Fred, on the state? Is there a Louisiana Health Service Corps type of...
We have that.
For loan repayment?
We have those individuals in the state.
You did that? Yeah.
Dr. Mack. Dr. Keith Ferdinand is a cardiologist who whose practice set on the edge of the lower ninth ward. Dr. Ferdinand was a cardiologist, but he also basically practiced primary care medicine. His office is gone. His patient population, patient base is gone. He told me the other day he's turning off his answering service. He kept it on to try to redirect patients, but he's turning off his answering service because, and I don't want to say that, he may not turn it off, but at that moment, he felt he may need to turn it off because it was so many horror stories that he couldn't do anything about. We talked earlier about how the healthcare system is infrastructure is intertwined with the infrastructure of the city, the state, et cetera, et cetera. Without the financial well-being of a community, you can't get the physicians to come back if they can't survive. Now, one thing we're trying to do is we're looking at a survey to try to survey those physicians to see who's interested. But the community outside of the safety net physicians for Louisiana, and then outside, we're talking about Mississippi, Alabama, you basically have to have something to entice the physicians to come back. As Fred said, it has to reimbursement issues with insurance has to be in place also. And then to your second issue, if I had to speak to Congress about electronic health record, continuity of care record, et cetera, if this is not an example of why we need it, when so many people are displaced away from home, it's become a burden on other health systems such as Houston, where they're taking care of a population they never intended to. Electronic health record could alleviate some of these issues. So this is definitely a case presentation of where we need it. And, of course, there are a number of other reasons.
Last question.
Hi, I'm Ben Springate. I'm from New Orleans. I'm with the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program. And I want to also echo the comments that have been made thanking Kaiser for the attention that they've been drawing to our region of the country. I want to follow up on the idea that where there are surging mental health needs and insufficient workforce and infrastructure to take care of that at this point. And I noted that in the layoffs, the massive layoffs that occurred in some of the health provider organizations, late last year and early this year that entire departments of psychologists were laid off, for instance. And some intact hospitals that previously served the mental health needs of the community have been closed down, even though they weren't flooded or destroyed. And so I'm wondering, as we look to, you know, stand up further services and try to provide services, you know, how can we take advantage of the fact that there may be underutilized providers in the area and underutilized facilities in the area that are essentially remaining closed at this point, as far as I can tell, because of a lack of reimbursement for mental health services? And is there an opportunity to build on the collaborative work with HHS or with private-public partnerships to try to address some of these concerns?
I think you're hitting Ben on some points that have deep roots, that, you know, issues that go back well before Katrina, and that is, you know, the way our mental health system is funded in the state. And there are, for hospitals today to open beds, I know there's a reluctance because of concerns about reimbursement for those patients. And so even going to a place and saying, look, if we can pay your cost to do this, will you be willing to do that? We've not had a lot of success with some of those conversations. So, and again, I think it, while we are trying to meet the demands that are presented before us today, you've also got businesses that are wondering about how they're going to meet their obligations to stay in business and that type of thing, and because of historically the way those services have been funded, I think there's just, you know, there's great doubt even if you say, look, if we fund these services, can you do that? Now we've had and these are conversations that have been going on for months in the area. So places where you've been able to identify space, like you've talked about, and you think, we ought to be able to do something there. It doesn't. It's not been terribly productive, and that's why the inpatient services have evolved all around the edge of the city in other public settings. Is because that's where we've been able to say, look, we'll open beds here. So a lot of those conversations are active and ongoing today. LSU is you know, bringing up they expect to have a hospital open later in the fall, as Karen said. The issue of mental health beds is going to have to be addressed with that as well. And so there's great frustration, great need, and another just, you know, complicated situation. But I think a lot of that goes to sort of historical funding of mental health services and how that's been done in the state. Like I said, We're breaking the rules and everything right now in terms of how things have been done in the past, how things are being done today. But there's a lot of calculations still being going on by people who were in business and wondering, you know, what's taking on this obligation going to mean?
I think our panel today has clearly demonstrated that Louisiana started with a substantial set of health issues and challenges, a large uninsured population, very poor health outcomes for some of the care that was given at a high cost, and got hit even harder by Katrina, struggles today to try and build a better system for the future, one that hopefully will provide broader coverage for the population served, as well as rebuild the delivery system. They have a long way to go, and I hope all of you will be here with them, as the panel is, to try and help make a better future for the survivors of Katrina and the future people who will live and dwell in the Gulf region. So thank you all for coming. We have lunch for you outside at the conclusion of this, and thank you again for being here, and thank you to the panelists for sharing with us.